back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 15,000 reporters covered this week's Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. In a piece called Reporters, Why Are You in Tampa? Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at City University of New York, writes, I challenge every journalist to answer this. Why are you there? What will we learn from you? What actual reporting can you possibly do that delivers anything of value more than the infomercial, light on the info, heavy on the mercial, that the conventions have become? Would you be better off back at home covering voters and their issues? Can we in the strapped news business afford this luxury? Now, the convention got wall-to-wall coverage. So what did you learn this week? Did you know, for example, that the convention cost $100 million? I learned that from a local TV show in Tampa, Florida. $50 million from corporate sponsors and $50 million from taxpayers. Did you know that the Tampa area has the highest homeless rate in the country? Well, joining us to talk about this is Justin Peters, editor-at-large for the Columbia Journalism Review. He's written for a number of publications, including Slate, The Washington Monthly, and The New York Times. He was in Tampa this week, and in his piece, A Celebration of Access in Tampa, he writes, quote, it took me 2 minutes to get kicked out of Liberty Plaza. That was all the time I needed. Liberty Plaza, sponsored by various conservative advocacy groups, is a tent city set up to entertain delegates and Republican donors. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. I enjoyed your piece. We're also joined by Trevor Aronson, Associate Director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. His forthcoming book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism, will be out in January. Trevor was awarded the 2012 Mali National Journalism Prize for his Mother Jones article, Informants, which exposes the massive network of FBI informants operating in U.S. Muslim communities. And Trevor says the convention was nothing more than a three-day infomercial. Hi, Trevor. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Justin, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I want to give credit to the people at the Tampa Bay Times. It's the local newspaper here in Tampa. It's one of the best papers in the country, and they really covered this convention. They'd put out these 32-page special editions in conjunction with Politico every single day, just covering every conceivable angle of the stuff that was going on in and around the convention zone. So, I mean, it was a lot of really great effort from them, and I want to specifically single out the people at PolitiFact. PolitiFact is the real-time fact-checking operation that the Tampa Bay Times runs, and throughout the convention, every night, they had a dedicated team of reporters and researchers watching the speeches and checking the factual accuracy of the statements that were made therein, and then posting the items up on their site, politifact.com. And I think that the whole fact-checking thing has become much, much bigger since the last convention cycle, and I think they were doing a really solid job of trying to keep the politicians honest.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Do you think that facts actually matter this time around? Do you think that reporters are doing a good job of listening to someone like a Paul Ryan, for example, and going through what he says to let us know what is fact and what is not?
It depends. It's really weird because, you know, when Paul Ryan gave his speech, as it was happening, Twitter sort of blew up, and, you know, everybody sort of online was saying, wait, this is one of the least factually accurate speeches that has perhaps ever been made in human history.
Right.
So, like, people knew it was happening, but on the next day, news coverage at the major papers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the front page story was just a typical thing that has been leading papers for decades, just a straightforward rundown of the speech, and any sort of fact-checking of Ryan's baldly false statements were relegated to the paper's websites. Now, you know, today the Times did, on their front, run a big sort of fact-check of Ryan's piece, but the sort of question remains, well, if you knew it was wrong or misleading at the first place, then why didn't that make it in to the sort of day one coverage of the speech. It's sort of a weird time gap.
And, you know, I'd love to talk about this later in the show because Think Progress has a piece called How the Media Soft Plays Paul Ryan's Lies, Factual Shortcuts, Perceived Inaccuracies, and Questionable Claims. And they looked at everybody from CNN to Politico to the New York Times and NPR to look at how they're dealing with these lies. So I'd love to ask you all how the media should deal with this a little later in the show. And also quickly, we'll also talk about the Tampa Bay Times coverage because I'd love to know what they did as a local paper as all of these delegates and 15,000 reporters come to their area. So we'll talk about that later in the show. Thank you for that. And Trevor, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I thought, you know, since this would be a show largely about the Republicans, I wanted to point out a story that was a really good take on some of the Obama administration's policies. Helen O'Neill at the Associated Press had a story that looked at deportations. And this is a topic we've paid attention to at the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, which is that, you know, the Obama administration's official line is that they're prioritizing deportations of criminals. And in fact, what's happening is that oftentimes non-criminals are being deported. And the way that the Associated Press advanced the story most recently was a look at the number of parents who are being deported. And by that, I mean, these are people who have had children in the United States. Those children are U.S. citizens. And the United States and immigration authorities are choosing to deport these parents. At the same time, these children are then put forward to judges who decide that it's actually in the best interest of the children to stay in the United States, not go with their parents, and instead go into adoption and foster systems. And it's really just this policy that's tearing children apart from their parents. At the same time, the Obama administration is saying, well, here we are, we're going to prioritize deportations to violent offenders and criminals, when the truth on the ground is that that isn't the case at all.
It seems like this is starting to get actually more attention, this issue.
I think it is. You know, I think that, you know, I think the problem is that the policy is one thing. The Obama administration wants to make this happen. But, you know, when we've looked at immigration records, I think the problem is how, you know, the people on the ground, how they're prioritizing deportations and the use of this so-called prosecutorial discretion, where the U.S. government is supposed to look at the circumstances of the potential deportee. And if it's such that, you know, they should stay. You know, the Associated Press found a woman whose husband was a naturalized U.S. citizen, had three children who were natural-born U.S. citizens, and still she was deported. You know, obviously that's something that, you know, immigration authorities should be looking at and saying, well, hey, you know, this sounds like this is a reason for this person to stay. There's really no good reason to deport her. Whereas they should be, obviously, you know, prioritizing people who have committed violent crimes and don't have family commitments in the United States.
Right. And that's Trevor Aronson with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. And now I would like to welcome Luke Harding to the show. Luke is a foreign correspondent with The Guardian, and he has been covering the ongoing violence in Syria, where last weekend more than 300 people were reportedly killed. Human Rights Watch reports that people standing in a bread line were bombed, and the number of refugees continues to climb. I should say that Luke is also author of Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. Hi, Luke. Welcome back to the show.
Very good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad we connected with you. So what did you see this week, Luke, that you thought was done well in the media?
Well, there was a really rather wonderful piece by my colleague Martin Chulov, who's the sort of Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. And he principally has been covering the war in Syria. And we were both there more or less at the same time. But I left earlier this month, and he's just emerged from another kind of grueling trip there and written just a kind of great piece in this week's Guardian, setting the scene and just talking about how the Arab Spring, which we saw start in Tunisia and then spread rapidly to Libya, to Egypt, has kind of come juddering to a stop in Syria, where really there's just the most terrible civil war going on between the rebels on one side, between the opposition, and this entrenched military dictatorship with heavy weapons, with tanks, with artillery, that's just kind of remorselessly targeting not just the rebels, but also people living in civilian areas, as you say, bread lines and so on. And it's just a dark conflict with no redeeming features. And I think Martin captured that very well, the kind of sense of hopelessness on the ground, and really the uncertainty as to where this war goes next.
You know, it's really hard to grasp what's happening, Luke. We linked to Martin's piece on our website, yourcallradio.org. He writes, 18 months and more than 23,000 bodies later, and with no end in sight to the chaos ravaging the country, their worst fears are being realized on a scale that continues both to horrify and numb. So 23,000 dead. He also writes that whatever its outcome, there is a civil war being fought on a fault line that threatens the entire Middle East. So give us a little context. What exactly is happening here?
Well, I mean, the fault line that Martin talks about is a very real one, although it's blurred, so we have to be a bit careful. But first of all, there's undoubtedly a sectarian dimension to what's happening in Syria. The country is run by a kind of Shia Alawite sect. President Bashar al-Assad is an Alawite. But they're a minority. The majority of people in Syria are Sunni Muslims, about 70% of them. There are other denominations as well. There are Christians, there are Armenians. There are Kurds. It's one of the oldest places on earth, thousands of years old, where these communities have coexisted for a very long time. But the problem now is that this insurrection is mainly driven by the Sunnis, by the rural poor, by painters and decorators. Although there are some intellectuals as well who support it, and some Alawites too. But there's this sectarian dimension, and also that spills over into the whole region, because the main country which is backing President Assad is Iran, a neighboring Shia state. And, of course, those who are supporting the rebels, including Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's new president, who was talking about this week, a Sunni. And so you have Saudi Arabia, you have Qatar, sending in arms to the opposition. And you also have fears that this conflict could have a kind of growing Islamist dimension, that some of the groups fighting in Syria are explicitly Islamist, that they're religious groups, and so on. Although I have to say, when I was there, the Syrians I met who were fighting the regime, many of them are educated. Many of them say that they took up weapons extremely reluctantly, that they want a civil state, as they call it, and they want a democracy. So there's no one group there, but. As I said, the problem is nobody knows where this conflagration is heading. And meanwhile, the death toll goes up every day.
If you have any questions for Luke Harding about coverage of Syria, we're basically getting BBC headlines on a regular basis, but I'm not sure people understand what's really happening on the ground. So if you have any questions for Luke, this would be a great time to call. He'll be with us for about 10 more minutes at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Luke, how are the people dealing with this? Because yesterday we heard a report, I believe it was from the BBC, that children are showing up in Jordan by themselves because their parents have either been killed or they're hoping that their parents will eventually follow them. And then you've got about 200 Syrian refugees crossing the borders of Turkey, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon, including more than 80,000 in Turkey alone. So how are average people dealing with what's happening?
Well, I mean, the situation is pitiful. I mean, it's absolutely pitiful. I've done this journey myself, and to escape from Syria, you have to kind of crawl through a hole in the barbed wire fence and try and kind of dodge the Turkish police. In a way, I mean, the biggest problem for people living in Syria is just getting to the border. I mean, there are very few vehicles. The price of bread has gone up. I mean, there's not much to eat. Mm. You know, even I, as a journalist, lost a couple of kilos when I was there for 10 days. And it's hot, and it's difficult. And I think the single worst thing is really the absolutely kind of brutal tactics that the Assad regime is using. What they're doing is they, where there is an opposition area or an area where the civilian population is known to be sympathetic to the rebels, the tactic is this: the Syrian army encircles it. It then shells it relentlessly for a period of days and sometimes even weeks. No one is able to escape. There are snipers on roofs and on schools. Then finally, the government troops, together with the Shabia, which is a kind of murderous pro-government militia, go in and go alley by alley, house by house, really just killing anybody they think is a rebel or a rebel sympathizer. And we've just seen last week, we saw in Daraya, a town just outside Damascus, the capital, we saw 400 people, according to people we've spoken to, who were shot dead. Really, the butchery here is just quite astonishing. And obviously, civilians are trying to flee, but it's very hard for them. It's very hard for them to escape. I mean, the other thing is what the international community can do about this. At the moment, beyond humanitarian aid, the international community is not doing a great deal.
And how do you, as a reporter, deal with the war on the narrative from the rebel side and from the regime? When you've got a situation of various outside players, like you just mentioned, a geopolitical hotspot, and then a lack of on-the-ground reporting, how do you really report on what's happening on the ground?
Well, I mean, I think the key thing is to go there. I was sort of frustrated with reporting the conflict secondhand, so I decided I would sort of smuggle myself into Syria and to see what's going on. And certainly my methods, I think, are kind of good old-fashioned reporting methods that you just go in and you talk to people and you see what's going on and you drive around and you go to front lines and so on. And really, the impression I got very strongly was that, despite the fact that there is some outside influence, this is really it's a revolution. It's a sort of emancipation movement. It's just a massive protest against a very barbarous regime. This all started about 17 months ago with a few demonstrations. The problem was the Assad regime responded brutally. It arrested people. It tortured them in custody. It killed some people. It shot unarmed demonstrators. And of course, like a fire, the kind of revolution spread, and it now really has engulfed the entire country. It's a kind of mosaic of regime and anti-regime, with the Free Syrian Army, the main opposition group, in control of most of the countryside, especially around the periphery in the north and the south. And the regime in the big cities. And I have to tell you, I mean, just to give you a picture, Syria is beautiful where I was staying. I was staying with a local family. You know, there were fig trees. There were donkeys plodding around the streets. And there's this kind of biblical landscape of mountains and shimmering olive groves. It really is an astonishing place, but just convulsed at the moment by this great tragedy.
So sad. And I want to bring on our other guests, Trevor or Justin. Have you been following this, and do you have any questions for Luke? Trevor?
Yeah, Luke, I was wondering if you could talk about the international involvement, especially with the U.S. and concerns about the U.S. really taking a strong line either way.
Yes, well, I think that there's no prospect of the U.S. intervening in Syria. I think that's been made very clear by the administration. The curious thing is some of the commentary I've been reading has been saying, you know, that this Syria has become a kind of cockpit of foreign powers and so on, that weapons are being shipped in. And this is very much what the regime is saying, what Assad's officials are saying, that the U.S. is somehow behind this conflict. But the strange thing is when you're on the ground, when you're traveling with these rebels, many of whom were, as I said, doing kind of civilian jobs until quite recently, they're saying, we haven't got any weapons at all. Look at my Kalashnikov. You know, the end is falling off. We can't afford bullets. You know, we want weapons. I think we have to be kind of very careful about exaggerating the extent to which other countries are being involved. I mean, I think what the United States can do is certainly to try and bolster the Syrian opposition and certainly to try and engage with the rebels. But the problem is none of this will change the kind of bloody reality on the ground where 200, 300 people a day are being killed. And the Free Syrian Army, they have Kalashnikovs and their enemies. The regime, they have tanks. And it's just a completely asymmetric conflict. And the losers, of course, are the civilians.
Luke, are you familiar with the piece that ran in the New York Times in June by Eric Schmidt? He reports that a small number of CIA officers are operating secretly in southern Turkey, helping allies decide which Syrian opposition fighters across the border will receive arms. Are you familiar with this?
Well, I'm familiar with that, but I would say good luck with that project. I mean, what you have to bear in mind is when you're inside Syria, everything takes place on a very kind of micro scale. You have kind of local guys who rose up in their village against the sort of Ba'ath Party headquarters and took control. And then they sort of formed together into little groups, into units. Some of them very secular, some of them a bit more Islamist, but really just with a few guns. And it's a very small kind of homespun movement. And while there is coordination between rebel groups, I mean, this is not an army in a conventional sense. It's sort of a lot of the people there are just teenagers, sort of 17, 18 with a gun, sometimes quite nervous, some with more military experience. So I think the big problem, even if the U.S. were to go down this road, as the Schmidt article suggests, is, you know, who do you talk to? Who is your interlocutor, and which groups do you arm? And I think you can't really answer that question because, as I said, the rebel movement is so diffuse. And also what we're seeing in Kurdish areas, for example, is the Kurds in the north have risen up and also kind of taken control of their own areas as well.
And Justin, do you have any questions for Luke before we let him go?
Yeah, Luke, how many foreign reporters would you say are in Syria right now, if you had to hazard a guess?
It's not a big number. I mean, certainly when I was there earlier this month, there were, I would say, in the region of perhaps 25 or 30 reporters. And I did come across, a few American reporters who come in who've been pretty intrepid and some Europeans as well. I mean, one of the problems covering this story also, I have to say, is that the Assad regime won't give visas to most journalists. A few who the regime think are sort of sympathetic get a 10-day visa and allowed to fly to Damascus. But most of us have had to enter illegally. And literally, in my case, you know, crawl through the razor wire so that I emerge with my kind of pants,
wow,
you know, kind of falling off. And a very friendly Syrian guy, you know, lent me a pair of his trousers. And so, I mean, I've been in Iraq and I've been in Afghanistan and other pretty scary places, but I think Syria was really the most grueling assignment I've done,
wow,
just because it's so unpredictable.
And Luke, we have just a couple minutes left. Were you in touch with any local journalists? I just wonder for them.
I mean, the thing is, there's been hundreds of young Syrian activists who've kind of become journalists. I mean, the way we've seen this war, experienced this war, has been through videos. And I met a young guy, for example, who went to Lebanon. He learned how to upload video to YouTube. And now he kind of goes around videoing protests, demonstrations, battles. And some of the videos from the fighting in Aleppo, for example, in the north, I mean, they look like Stalingrad. It's just the most vivid scene of a few men with RPGs fighting tanks in these dusty alleyways, cries of Allahu Akbar. It's just astonishingly kind of vivid and being fought out in real time. So
these
journalists are very much part of the revolution.
Oh, it'd be amazing to have one of them on. Are you planning to go back soon?
I think yes, but not yet.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Luke. We appreciate your reporting, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's Luke Harding. He's foreign correspondent with The Guardian. And like he said, he has to basically be sort of smuggled into Syria. And you can read his reporting as well as his colleague Martin Chuloff at yourcallradio.org. And when we come back, we will switch gears and talk about coverage of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. $100 million, 15,000 reporters. So what did you learn? It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio, KALW, has our membership campaign beginning next Thursday. We'll be keeping the programming in uninterrupted the way you like it. And you can help keep this drive as short as possible by making a contribution at KALW.org today. Every pledge that comes in now will count towards the goal. When we reach the goal, which is $325,000, we'll wrap up the drive. Join listeners like Paul Gaglione of Nevada City and Sophia Cardoni of San Francisco, who have given early to help end the drive sooner at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a special Labor Day show with Simon Cordery. He's out with a new book about Mother Jones. She was called the most dangerous woman in America for her effective and creative labor organizing back in 1902. And it's amazing to think that she got started in her 60s. And she was incredibly effective, said things back then that, well, if she said now, I wonder how she'd be treated on something like Fox News. So we will talk about Mother Jones on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We are going to switch gears and talk about coverage of the Republican National Convention, and we'd love to hear from you. 15,000 reporters went to Tampa to cover this, so what did you learn? Wall-to-wall coverage, 866-798-8255. How do you think these conventions, these speeches, should be covered? And if there was another story you saw this week that didn't get the attention it deserves because of the conventions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment or a link to the article at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Justin Peters, editor-at-large for the Columbia Journalism Review. You can see his latest piece, A Celebration of Access in Tampa, at yourcallradio.org. He says it took him 2 minutes to get kicked out of Liberty Plaza, and that's all the time he needed. We're also joined by Trevor Aronson, associate director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. He says the convention was nothing more than a three-day infomercial. So why don't we start off by talking about money? Trevor, you live in Florida. Where do you live in Florida?
I'm in St. Petersburg.
In St. Petersburg. Okay. So I read that St. Petersburg is actually having financial difficulty like so many other towns across the country. And yet this convention cost $100 million total, $50 million grant from the federal government, and then $50 million from the taxpayer. Yet in the wall-to-wall coverage that I heard, I rarely heard that $100 million number. Was it getting much coverage at the local level?
You know, the local newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times, did some pretty extensive coverage on the costs associated with this event. You know, and I think the justification for, you know, taxing a city like St. Petersburg and Tampa with an event like this is to say, you know, this is going to have enormous economic activity, and it's going to, you know, every dollar spent by taxpayers is going to roll over and over and be worth, you know, hundreds of dollars in local economic impact. But I think that's the real question of whether that actually happened. You know, when you look at what happened in Tampa and St. Petersburg, the RNC basically, you know, cordoned off sections of each city in St. Petersburg for the kickoff event and then in Tampa for the actual convention, you know, creating this bubble where, you know, delegates and journalists were just, you know, cordoned into one section of the city. And there really weren't a lot of people going to restaurants and bars in the areas. You know, most of the economic activity was centered on, you know, hotel beds being filled. And so, you know, for how this benefits a city like Tampa, I think is a real question, whether it's worth the money and hassle that a city has to invest to attract a convention like this.
Well, according to WFMY, the local TV station there, the $50 million included $1 million in security for the kickoff party, $11 million for technology, $3 million in gear, $500,000 for police uniforms, $38,000 for 48 horses in riot gear. And Justin, this was the other angle that didn't really get much attention. A lot of people were wondering why the streets were not filled with protesters like we saw in 2008. And the Washington Post, for example, has a piece called Protesters Blame Hurricane Threat and Police Presence for Muted Protests During the GOP Convention. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink was on Democracy Now! This morning. A number of Code Pinkers stood up during Mitt Romney's speech, and she said that she spoke to a lot of locals who said they didn't want to come out onto the streets because of the heavy police presence.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the number of police officers who were on duty in Tampa, not just locals, but policemen come from miles around just driving down to get in on the action. And in terms of what you were saying earlier about the economic benefit to Tampa, I know I was out at some bars and restaurants this week, and the people who are running them were complaining. They're saying this is the worst week we've ever had because nobody wants to come out and walk through this police gauntlet to enjoy themselves. In terms of the protests, I'll tell you, I was out last night right as Mitt Romney was getting up to give his speech, walking over to the designated protest zone. And it was very, very, very hard
to find and to get there because the RNC and the police set up this very intricate maze of barriers and fences and cordons that if you actually wanted to get to the protest zone, which as the crow flies was no more than maybe a fifth of a mile from the forum, you had to walk what seemed like a mile and a half. And when you got there to this weedy, empty, vacant lot with no lights and nobody around to actually hear what you were protesting about, the protesters were outnumbered by the police who were there standing around on bicycles, on horses, and I think all of those things combined with the weather just made it seem like, what's the point? What are we actually doing here? Although I have to say, the police were very, very friendly. I was out with a friend who has covered Occupy in 30 different cities for the Boston Phoenix, and he was saying that the Tampa sheriff deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for keeping as much order as they did this week and being unfailingly polite. But I think the fact remains, I think it was the police that inhibited the protest that you would have expected to be going on during this whole thing.
And the Tampa City Council approved measures to restrict speech and demonstrations. The New York Times reports that the ordinance requires a permit for groups of 50 or more to gather in parks, sets a limit of 90 minutes on parades, bans an array of items, including glass bottles, aerosol cans, and pieces of rope longer than 6 feet. So since you were out trying to get through this maze, did you see many, maybe a handful of the 15,000 reporters, did any of them bother to go outside to actually interview some of the people on the streets?
There were about maybe 10 or 12 reporters out there last night, combined with, I guess, the other 14,988 inside the convention center. And that's another thing that I was writing about this week. It took so long to actually get inside the convention center that once you were in there, it was extraordinarily difficult to leave, and most people just didn't even bother. It all goes into what I think is the point of this sort of thing for the media, or at least what the RNC is trying to do. They're trying to control access to the various places where things are going on, to keep reporters in certain places and keep them out of certain places so that they're more likely to write the sorts of stories that they expect. And so, you know, instead of going out in the swampy Tampa heat and braving fences and thunderstorms to go out and actually interview ordinary people who are being affected by the policies being debated inside the convention center, it's much easier for a reporter to say, well, it took me 40 minutes to get in here. It's air conditioned. They have free internet and free coffee. I'm just going to sit down, open my laptop, and watch the speeches on television and write about what I'm seeing.
And as you wrote, hang out in the Google Lounge where there was, a treadmill with a desk connected to it and massage chairs.
Oh, it was the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
But the place was packed with reporters, right?
Yeah, all day long. People just love getting free stickers and sitting in photo booths.
I mean, everybody from the local newspaper reporter to, like, Geraldo Rivera, I understand, was in this room.
Oh, yeah, it was a cavalcade of stars. I mean, you'd see people, hey, you know, there's that guy I see on MSNBC. Hey, there's a congressman. And we're all sitting there. I'm guilty of it, too. I spent more time than I should have, you know, sitting in a massage chair, which was very, very pleasant. But it's the sort of thing that when you take a step back, you have to ask, what are we doing here?
Right. Well, that's it. What were they doing here? Because that is the question that Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at City University of New York, writes. Why are you in Tampa at a time when so many papers are cutting back? It probably cost around $2,000 a person to send them there with the food and the hotel and everything. So how do you answer that question, Trevor? Why were so many reporters there? And if you are going to go there, how should you cover something like this?
I mean, I think for me, you know, with Jeff Jarvis's column, it really made the rounds in media. And what surprised me about that was that his question was really all that surprising. You know, for example, similar things happen with the Olympics, where you have reporters who, you know, hundreds and thousands of reporters around the world go to cover the Olympics, and their level of access is in a room where, you know, an Olympic gold medalist is fielding questions from, you know, 60 or 70 reporters, and they all go home and write the same story. You know, in the national political convention like this, it's even worse because you have even more reporters, and there really aren't any surprises. So they're all, you know, stuck in this one place with really having very little access to write about anything. And as Justin clearly said, you know, what ends up happening is that the message becomes very controlled, and it ends up being the type of stories they want to have written. You know, I think what's happened here a little bit, you know, this touches on what we were discussing earlier in the show about, you know, fact-checking what happens. You know, this year I think there's been an extraordinary level of you know, untruths that have been said. I mean, when you look back at the 2008 campaign, you know, there were, you know, problems that were associated with Obama that weren't necessarily fair, such as the Bill Ayers connection. Mm-hmm. And it never came directly from the campaign, or it never was clear. It wasn't like they were calling Obama necessarily a terrorist. And when you look back and you think, what, you know, there was that moment when McCain, you know, takes a question or someone yells out, you know, Barack Obama's a Muslim, and McCain says no, and acts very statesmanlike and says, you know, that's not true. And here, what we saw was actually the media, I'm sorry, the you know, Romney and Ryan, like, you know, basically lying and knowing they're lying and really raising, like, kind of changing the rules and breaking the rules for campaigns and putting the media in this position where here we have 15,000 reporters covering the convention, and it was really surprising, as Justin got to, that there really wasn't as much pushback from the media in saying this was untrue. You know, there was some of this. You know, Ezra Klein wrote a good article about Ryan's speech where, you know, he basically pointed out that it was actually difficult to find actual facts in the piece, find things that were true in his speech. And I think that raises a real question. Like, here we have 15,000 reporters. These are people that should be, you know, in the cliche, speaking truth to power. And in many cases, they are just stenographers for what is essentially a really, really long infomercial that is just so tightly controlled. And I think that's a real question. I mean, I think Jeff Jarvis has a really good point in questioning why media organizations, as strapped as they are, you know, sending everyone to a convention like this. And then the second question is, if there are that many people covering it, you know, maybe they should be much more aggressive in the types of stories they're pursuing.
Well, we decided, we were thinking about maybe doing live coverage last night to open the lines, but we thought, what would we add to the conversation, right? And so we decided not to. And it seems like a lot of outlets don't make that decision. They just sort of go with the pack, and I don't know if they think, hopefully we'll do something different. Trevor, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, do you think it's a stretch for me to wonder why, in a place like Tampa, the Tampa-St. Petersburg area has the highest rate of homelessness in the nation, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, 57 homeless for every 10,000 residents. Now, if I went to Tampa, I would have gone to, like, a shelter or a food bank to find out, you know, what was going on. Is that a stretch?
No, and actually that would be the great stories to write about. But what ended up happening, and it's actually, you know, something I'm very critical of, is, you know, the press came to town and they had very little access to, you know, the politicians and the people that they would want to write about. And so they end up looking around and saying, okay, well, what story am I going to write? And an obvious story is, well, let's describe Tampa. But instead of looking at Tampa as, you know, a microcosm for the United States and looking at how, you know, policies maybe that Romney and Ryan are proposing would affect a place like Tampa, they really wrote what were essentially, you know, travel articles about Tampa that were, like, parochial in the most offensive way. You know, for the most part, when you looked at how Tampa was described, it wasn't, you know, going in and looking at the problems like homelessness and looking at what's happening that's right here. Instead, it became, you know, this description of a massive parking lot surrounded by strip clubs and fast food joints, which really isn't the Tampa that I know or the ones that my friends know. And, you know, it to me, that was the offensive part, that you have all these reporters from New York and D.C., they really don't know the area very well, and they drop into town, they're frustrated and hot, and they don't have access to anyone, and so then they write these stories that really don't add anything to the discussion and end up being kind of, you know, thumbing their nose at what they think of as a second-tier city in the United States.
Well, what else do we need to know about the economic situation in Tampa? The unemployment rate is 9%. That doesn't include underemployed people. And then going back to the homeless, 16,000 in the area, 1 in 5 children. What else do we need to know about Tampa and the surrounding area?
Right, and the way that Tampa is very much like ahead of the trend in the United States is in employment. You know, when you look at the employment growth under Obama, you know, employment has increased, but they've largely been in low wage, low skilled jobs. And the employment in the Tampa Bay area is very similar. There are very few high paid, high skilled jobs. Instead, it's jobs in the service industry. It's hotel workers, it's restaurant workers, and you know those are great jobs, but they're not the type of jobs that we can build an economy around alone. And you know what's ended up happening is that when you look at employment growth in the United States, just as you look at the employment growth in Florida, you know, our governor here, Rick Scott, a Republican, has touted how jobs have grown under his watch, but in truth, the jobs that have actually been created are very bad ones that you wouldn't want, and aren't going to help people get into middle class homes, aren't going to help bolster the middle class. And I think that's one area that we could have looked at. The other area that, this is the epicenter of the foreclosure crisis. Mm. And, it still very much is a problem. There are people that can't afford homes. There are people whose credit is so bad that they probably will never be able to get homes. And, it's created this backwards economy that, it's hard to know what's going to happen here because job growth is happening, but it's happening in areas that you wouldn't want it to happen necessarily. And it's also created a market where so much of the economy was based on housing, and now that market has just collapsed, and the government programs to, get it back on its feet, haven't been that effective.
That is Trevor Aronson, Associate Director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. We're also joined by Justin Peters, Editor-at-Large for the Columbia Journalism Review. And we've got about 10 minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in and let us know what you learned this week from the wall-to-wall coverage of the convention, what angles do you think reporters should take? 15,000 reporters in one town. How should they cover something like the convention? Where did you see good coverage? And next week is the DNC convention in Charlottesville. So what are your thoughts on how that one should also be covered? And if there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. I wanted to know what the reporters were saying behind the scenes about the extraordinary Clint Eastwood speech, especially when he started talking about how Romney would pull out of Afghanistan tomorrow.
Yes, okay, so
never talked to the and Obama never bothered to study Russian history in Afghanistan and so forth.
So, I'm glad you brought this up, Harry. So for those that weren't lucky enough to watch the speeches last night, Clint Eastwood came out and was talking to an empty chair. He was pretending that President Obama was in the chair, and he was unscripted. And apparently, the Romney campaign, they were just not very happy with what he was saying. But you know what's amazing, Trevor and Justin? When I heard the analysis after Clint Eastwood's speech, the talking heads were basically dumbfounded. They didn't know what to say. But what I thought was fascinating is Clint Eastwood ripped on President Obama for not closing Guantanamo and for not bringing the soldiers home tomorrow, basically. And I thought, you're saying this to a Republican crowd, and he actually got some applause for this. So we're fed this line about what these Republicans believe when he's talking about closing Guantanamo and bringing the troops home. He's getting applause. But none of the commentators pointed that out. Trevor, did you catch that?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, and it was particularly interesting given that they later pointed out that, Romney didn't salute the troops, so to speak, in his speech. I think that was kind of a funny side note. I don't know what the reporters had to say about this, behind closed doors, because I didn't talk to anyone about this specifically, although obviously I was watching television this morning and hearing what the talking heads had to talk about it. And, certainly it was a question of how much Eastwood went off script, and seemed to be like a pretty funny anecdote in what was otherwise a really, tightly choreographed event, in that they apparently had the red light on him for a good 5 minutes before, trying to get him off the stage while he continued to talk.
That kills me. I'm sorry to jump in
here.
Yeah,
please.
But I completely agree with Trevor. What kills me is so many of these reporters who are covering these sorts of staged events are just looking for someone who deviates from the norm, who does something that's unexpected. And when they do that, that's what becomes the news. Oh, my goodness. Clint Eastwood was talking to a chair. And, everyone laughs. Look at him. He's so old and funny. But, you don't have any attention paid to the actual substance of what he was saying, and it's very difficult to find anyone who wants to go any deeper beyond just
oh, man, what a weird speech that was. He's crazy. It drives me nuts.
Right. Well,
in some ways, I feel like, you know, coverage of these things is like the coverage of, you know, Spider-Man, the musical in New York, where everyone, you know, had bad things to say about or looks for their funny angle and criticizing it or having, you know, their one little angle and moving it forward. It's kind of the same thing, but on a larger scale and with politics, that, you know, they find that one little piece that they can run with and point out as being absurd or amusing.
Politics is theater, absolutely. Right.
Well, thank you for calling in, Harry. Let's hear next from Remy calling from South Florida. Hi, Remy.
Yeah, hi. No, I just wanted just to give you my feedback as to, you know, it's such a close race that when you began to see, let's say, Chris Christie, Marco Rubin, everybody speak, and they promoted themselves so much, and there was so little said about the candidate, I ended up getting the impression that most of them, they really don't believe that Romney's anything more than a placeholder, mm-hmm. and they're already preparing for 2016. That's what I ended up getting from it, from the way people spoke. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Right, thank you. Well, yeah, we don't want to spend too much time on this, but Chris Christie was criticized for not bringing up Mitt Romney's name until more than half of the way into the speech. And he talked mostly about himself. But what are your thoughts on that, just quickly, Justin?
Well, yeah, it was weird. You would expect someone who is speaking at, you know, a convention to, you know, praise and nominate the presidential candidate to actually mention that candidate. But I think the caller is not incorrect, and I certainly feel there's a sentiment among the media that this race looks a little bit closer than it is, that Obama will probably pull it out, and that 2016 will be the next really interesting election. That's sort of the sense I'm getting from talking to people.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
I was in the shower for a lot of this program, but I'm so glad somebody mentioned Clint Eastwood because I caught his speech later. It was on one of the PBS stations, and I was absolutely appalled. I mean, I listened to what he said, and, you know, I said a lot of things about Bush, but I wasn't public speaking. And here is this guy. You know, I don't care who the president is. At least show the office some respect. I mean, when he was talking about, you know, that, you know, talking to this empty chair, which was so weird. And then he said, you know, we all know what he meant when he said, you know, I can't go, you know, F myself either. And, I mean, it was horrible. I mean, it was crude, it was vulgar, it made no sense. And, it, you know, and I felt badly because, you know, they should have let this guy alone, you know, kind of go out of the world, at least somewhat dignified. But, you know, he was scratching his hair. I thought he was going to scratch his crotch. And
well,
fell out of bed. I'm sure Ann Romney was appalled.
I think they needed a star, and that's what they got, right? Because, no, seriously, you need a star to show up at these events, and that's what they got. And I'm sure the person that booked him was excited, but then who knows what kind of conversation they're having today.
Yeah.
But thank you for calling in. And also, just if you didn't catch it, there were lots of chants of USA, USA. Clint Eastwood said, we own this country. A lot of we want our country back. That was pretty much the convention. I also wanted to give kudos to Kate Shepard at Mother Jones. Trevor, you brought up low-paying jobs, and the Staples CEO gave a speech in favor of Mitt Romney. And she pointed out that Staples is one of the 50 largest low-wage employers in the U.S. We're talking about an average of $10 an hour jobs. So, you know, here's another good, and her piece wasn't very long. It was kind of a blog post right after he spoke, but another really good story with some substance that you could take away from the convention. Justin or Trevor?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we need to see more of going into Charlotte. You know, people who are, you know, actually doing the sort of substantive work that, and it doesn't need to be long, but, you know, the sort of stuff that gives you a little bit of insight that penetrates the hard shell, that the sort of glossy finish that they're trying to throw over all of the goings-on, and that so many of the reporters here are content with just standing and admiring the reflection. You know, I really hope that we see more of that going into next week.
in general with, you know, politics and especially around, like, the heat of times now between now and the election, I mean, it really becomes a focus on, like, horse race coverage. And it's kind of sad that, you know, good pieces with perspective or pieces that point out, you know what's going on and the perspective of people that are, you know, making the donations and funding the campaigns, you know, that's actually a minority compared to, you know, just, you know, look at the gaffe that this politician said, or, you know, he's up 2 points in the polls. All of these things that are really inconsequential, and they almost cover, you know, politics more like a baseball game than really, you know, the high stakes that it is.
And also, Trevor, kudos to the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. I mean, you've got so many incredible stories up. Florida cuts to higher education hurting the middle class. State officials still turning down federal money for at-risk families. Scott attempts to reduce early voting in all counties. We talked about voter suppression just yesterday.
Yeah, you know, actually covering the convention has been a tough thing for us to figure out how we would go about it. And in the end, we chose to largely back off. You know, when most of the media is turning right, or we, you know, choose to turn left or go the opposite way. And, you know, when you have 15,000 reporters in town, we're not really sure, you know, what we can do. So it was kind of tough to figure out exactly how we fit into it. But we've tried to, like, you know, go after the important stories and pursue them even when they're not the ones that are necessarily going to result in a lot of page views.
I mean, this is a great story. Again, you know, if you're going here, why don't you talk about the federal money that they're turning down for at-risk families and these homeless people that are, you know, what is it, the population, 57 homeless for every 10,000 residents. We're almost out of time. What are you working on right now, Justin?
I actually spent a lot of the week following around a group of disabled reporters who work for a show called How's Your News.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have three disabled reporters who go and interview, you know, various politicians and, you know, dignitaries. Interview is sort of a stretch. These aren't, you know, hard-hitting pieces by any means. But what it does, and what I found really interesting, is when you go up to someone like a Michelle Bachmann or someone like that, or, well, maybe she's not the best example, but some politician who is, you know, polished within an inch of their life, and, you know, put them up against someone who can't really form words, you know, or, you know, can't speak English, you get this sort of unscripted reaction that you really sort of tells you something about person's character.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. I'd love to have you back to talk about that. That's fascinating. Justin Peters, editor with Columbia Journalism Review, and Trevor Aronson with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up on Monday. Who was Mother Jones, and what did she do for the labor movement? On the next Jour Call on Labor Day, we'll have a conversation with Simon Cordery, author of Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. In 1902, she was called the most dangerous woman in America for her effective and creative organizing. So how did she organize workers in the early 20th century? And what can we learn from her activism? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of Local Public Radio. In the past 2 years, KALW listeners have done something amazing. You've shown that public radio can effectively ask listeners for support without cutting into the shows you love. That's why we'll be keeping the programs intact during our fall membership campaign that begins next Thursday. That's also why we're going to raise the bar just a little further when it comes to keeping on-air fundraising to a minimum. In the next 12 months, we'll conduct only 2 on-air fundraisers. That means our fall drive will be the last until May. Every contribution that comes in now at KALW.org will be counted against our drive goal of $325,000. And when we hit that number, we will wrap things up. So please, give early and help us end the drive early. Thank you for your support and for keeping local public radio strong, and the pledge breaks short.
This is KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say from the BBC. I'm Ben James, and South Africa is where we're starting the conversation.
We thought those things were buried years ago in the democracy that were so hardly fought, were made for everyone to have a rainbow nation, and we experienced such a thing.
South Africa's justice minister wants an explanation of the decision to charge nearly 300 miners with murder over the deaths of 34 colleagues shot by police. We discussed the case itself earlier, but you're also discussing what this says about South Africa today. How far has the country come since the end of apartheid? Post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, are squatters criminals? Squatting becomes a criminal offence in England and Wales tomorrow, and you're reading about it around the world. Send us your questions now for squatters and the squatted.